Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Peter Forbes on behalf of the appellant, Jesse Lifschutz, who's also of record and at council table. Your Honor, this case begins back on June 26th of 2010 when Denver enacted ordinance number 333, series of 2010, adopting a new zoning code. We then fast forward to December 30, 2010. The appellee, ODM, goes into the Denver Zoning Department, the counter, and obtains a permit for a rooming and boarding use at 740 Clarkson Street. The fast forward now to a determination by the district court here in 2012 that that permit was issued in violation of the plain language, and that was the court's ruling, the plain language of ordinance number 333. The district court therefore ordered Denver to revoke that permit because it had been issued in violation of the underlying statute. That order to revoke the permit was stayed pending a trial of the counterclaim asserted, the cross-claim asserted by ODM against Denver, seeking to stop Denver from revoking that permit. Now, the unbroken line of appellate decisions in this state, going back to the Stackhouse case, is that a claim to stop a municipality from revoking a permit or taking action lies in equitable estoppel. Estoppel in pais, I believe is how it's pronounced, is the old doctrine. That is unbroken. There's not a single appellate case that I could find, or apparently that where the adversary could find, holding that a claim to stop the revocation of a permit, be it a building permit or a zoning permit, lies in promissory estoppel. Nonetheless, they would have you conclude that all those cases on all those years are incorrect. They would also have you conclude and rule in a manner contrary to what the Supreme Court held in the Delosier case, which is that a misrepresentation concerning authorized zoning constitutes a misrepresentation of fact. That is what the Supreme Court stated in Delosier. What they would have you hold is that let's not follow those cases, but instead let's find that the proper claim here is one for promissory estoppel.
And just to clarify, no one is suggesting it was an intentional misrepresentation. We're talking about a negligent representation by the clerk or the administrative officer.
That's correct. Yes. That's correct, Your Honor. The question of whether a claim like this can lie in promissory estoppel is an interesting one, at least for lawyers. But the problem we have here is that this court should not, and in fact may not even have the authority to reach that question, based on the Colorado Governmental Immunities Act. And that, that issue comes to this court. We brought it up on appeal. We did not raise it below, but it is properly before this court because it goes to subject matter jurisdiction. Cases are legion, as this court probably knows far better than the counsel before it. Cases are legion that the CGIA compliance with the notice requirements, failure to comply rather, divests the court of subject matter jurisdiction.
All right, well, Mr. Forbes, then let me ask this. Do you have any authority to support the argument that a private party, a non-governmental entity, can raise CJA jurisdictional challenge?
I have two sources of authority. One source of authority is that anybody can bring to the attention of the court subject matter jurisdiction. And in fact, this court is duty-bound to raise that by itself. So that's...
So the trial court was duty-bound in the first instance to raise it.
That's correct. That's correct. The second proposition doesn't go specifically to the CGIA, but we did cite federal authority. I couldn't find anything in Colorado saying that when you're permitted to intervene without qualification, you can raise any defense that's available, including subject matter jurisdiction. So
the opposing counsel points out footnote 6 in the Walton case.
Your Honor, I guess what I would say is that footnote does not address the issue here, which is subject matter jurisdiction and this court's duty to examine its subject matter jurisdiction. So whether we raise it or whether you raise it, the fact it's been raised needs to be examined. And that's what I'd like to proceed to now, which is basically the Robinson case, which is controlling at this point. Because even if one can assume that a claim like they're asserting here lies in promissory estoppel, if the allegations of the complaint or the underlying facts also establish that that claim could lie in equitable estoppel, Robinson says compliance with the CGIA is required. And here there was a finding, a specific finding by the district court, that the claim here would lie also in promissory estoppel based on the allegations of the complaint. And then ODM itself, that's in record page 1022, ODM conceded in its brief that the evidence satisfies equitable estoppel standards as well. So essentially we have a situation that's identical to Robinson. When you look at their complaint in this matter, which is found in the record between 111 and 120, the cross-claim says, in essence, that I went in, I asked Mr. Vatican what kind of permits I could get. He told me that I could get a permit for rooming and boarding. I got that permit for rooming and boarding. Paragraph 14, thereafter, ODM purchased 740 Clarkson because it had obtained the rooming and boarding permit for the property, and they allege reliance on that representation going forward. That is exactly what equitable estoppel deals with. They were told the permit was authorized. It was a negligent statement. It was an incorrect statement, but that was a factual statement according to the court in Delosier. And as an interesting aside, it seems to me in the private context, the courts in Colorado have held that representations about law and about zoning of property are representations of law, not representations of fact, and are therefore not even subject to reliance. But nonetheless, we have Delosier, which says that a representation concerning zoning, at least in this municipal estoppel context, is a representation of fact.
Can you clarify for me what you were just referring to? Is the conduct then the statement that you can get a permit, or the permit, the granting of the permit itself?
The conduct that was alleged in the complaint, or the cross-claim, excuse me, is that they said you could get a permit. All right. And so that is why this claim would also lie in equitable estoppel, even if one assumes the permit is a promise. And let me deal with that, because I think that was really where your question was going. The zoning permit is not a promise, and in fact can't be a promise, for several reasons. First of all, if you look at the zoning permit in this matter, on its face, there is no promissory language whatsoever. There's nothing that the city promises. It's in the record at 477. It doesn't contain any promissory language whatsoever. It just is a zoning permit, is all it is. That's number one. Number two, you look at the nature of zoning, and what is a zoning permit? Zoning is a legislative function. It is not something administrative agencies can do. An administrative agency can't zone. Only the legislative body can zone. So what is the zoning permit process? The zoning permit process is in a manner, and this goes back to Flynn versus Treadwell, is a way to administer the zoning code. And the way it's administered is somebody comes in, says, I'm interested in this property. What type of zoning can I get? Or more particularly, can I get this type of zoning? The zoning counter then looks up, and now it's computerized, looks up and says, okay, here's the applicable zoning for that property. These are the uses permitted for that property. And then if it's one of the permitted uses, they issue it as a matter of course. It's not a promise at all. It can't be a promise. They don't have the power to make a promise you can engage in that particular use. All they're doing is verifying that the requested use, according to their review, is authorized by the zoning code. Therefore, under Delosier, if they get that wrong, they've made a misrepresentation of fact as to what the zoning code permits. The third reason that a zoning permit can't be a promise relates to, again, the nature of the zoning power. If I'm issued a zoning permit or a particular use, and I walk out the door, the municipality technically can change the zoning for that property the very next minute. They're not bound to allow me to use that property. Now, at some point, my right can be vested, but that's a property rights doctrine. That doesn't relate to the nature of the zoning permit as a promise. That relates to the fact that I've taken action and my property rights are vested. So the zoning permit itself can't be a promise and isn't a promise. And it's never been recognized to be a promise by any appellate court in this state, and with good reason. Because it to recognize it as a promise would effectively vest in the administrative agency the power to make promises that, as a matter of separation of powers, that administration agency doesn't have. It can't promise land uses. It can't allow land uses that the legislative body hasn't authorized. So I think those are some of many reasons I think that a zoning permit can't be a promise. And in particular, why this zoning permit in this case was not and could not have been a promise. So that I think is, and then we go to the other CGIA issues. I don't think we need to detain ourselves long with them, because I think if you find that the CGIA applies here, it's well established, and then when you look at the language of 109.1, obviously a complaint or a cross claim doesn't constitute notice. The language says you've got to give notice of a claim. It says you then can't file your claim for 90 days after you give that notice. They've conceded here that the only thing that they've argued, I guess, is sort of conceded by negative implication, that the only thing that could arguably constitute a notice here is their cross claim. Obviously, that doesn't satisfy the statutory standard. In terms of accrual, law says accrual of a claim under the CGIA is when the injury occurs, not when everything else in your claim matures. It's when the injury occurs or you know of the injury. Misrepresentation, injury accrues, you know of it when you either know of the misrepresentation or you know of facts that should lead you to believe that there is a misrepresentation. Here, I think that in 2011, at the BOA hearing, obviously Denver stipulated that the permit here wasn't authorized by ordinance number 333, which was a fact that should have led them to understand that the permit wasn't authorized. The judge's order in July of 2012 specifically said it wasn't authorized. They had plenty of time to give notice. They didn't do it, so there's no jurisdiction. I will save the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 39 seconds.
Good afternoon. I'm Laura Sturgis, here representing Open Door Ministries. Open Door Ministries asks you to affirm the promise the city agrees that it made 3.5 years ago, that Open Door has relied upon since that time in operating its rooming and boarding house at 740 Clarkson. None of the issues opposing counsel now raises on appeal is either properly before the court or provides a basis for overturning that promise. Opposing counsel can't dispute that the city and Open Door, who are the only parties to the promise at issue, agree on every material fact that supports Judge Frick's summary judgment order. The Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, the CGIA, raised by the intervener as he admits for the first time on appeal, is a red herring that simply does not apply here for at least 5 reasons. First, Open Door's promissory estoppel claim does not implicate the CGIA. Second, regardless of Open Door's claim, the relief that Open Door requests, it does not implicate any tort-based theory or injury that would trigger the CGIA. Third, Mr. Lipschutz, as a private party intervener, may not here on appeal raise the CGIA on appeal on behalf of an unwilling public entity.
Do you have authority to support that?
There is no authority to support that a private party may raise it, and there is plenty of authority stating that it is the public entity's right to assert the CGIA, to decide to waive the CGIA, to settle a meritorious claim, and this, of course, is assuming that the CGIA applies at all. But if you look at the statute itself and Colorado Supreme Court case law and case law from this court interpreting the CGIA, the discussion is about whether the public entity can raise this issue, can waive this issue, can decide how this issue impacts its ability to maintain, to manage its finances, its business. This is the perfect example of a case where the city says, this is a case we think is meritorious and we want to let it resolve. I won't even say we want to settle it because they're not even in dispute.
Sorry to interrupt.
No worries.
I think the difference having trouble with here is the question of immunity and the question of jurisdiction. That is the threshold before we reach the question of immunity. obviously the governmental entity can decide to waive immunity or not. We don't reach that if we don't have a jurisdiction, if we have a jurisdiction problem.
There certainly is nothing to stop this court from evaluating whether it has subject matter jurisdiction here. That is something that this court can determine. And this court has subject matter jurisdiction here for all of the reasons why the CGIA does not apply. It's a promissory estoppel claim. It involves an injury that's not implicated by the CGIA. Also, there's an injury that has triggered the jurisdictional notice period that the CGIA requires. And as opposing counsel admits, the rest of the statute is simply not relevant at this point because it's all been waived by
Excuse
anybody.
Excuse me, counsel, if I might ask, Roosevelt versus Beaumont is a case that would seem to hold against you. It's an older case. I noticed that this even preceded my time. The rights of adjacent landowners, the Supreme Court recognized in Roosevelt versus Beaumont that sometimes for political reasons or other practical reasons, the city may want a change of zoning. For example, in Beaumont, it was a mall of some kind, a shopping center, and the homeowners didn't want it. So here we have a situation where we have adjacent homeowners who didn't claim they didn't get notice. We're not going into the facts, that's for the trial judge, but they claim they didn't have notice, and Beaumont said they have the adjacent landowners have an absolute right to come in and raise their issues, even though the city or municipality may feel differently. Can you distinguish that case?
I don't think that we need to distinguish that case, actually. I think that it does not change the fact that the intervener, Mr. Lipschutz, here has the right to come in and assert his rights as an adjoining landowner. The distinction is that he does not have the right then to stand in the shoes of a city who is now adverse to him. He wishes that the city did something differently with respect to this permit. He wishes that the city did something differently with respect to the zoning as it interpreted it on December 30th, 2010, and throughout the entire underlying litigation until Judge Frick's order about the status of that permit, but that does not give him the right then to assert the CGIA on behalf of this public entity.
But you have no law either way. He doesn't either, but you have none.
I think that actually the law as it stands, the statute itself, that language and language from Colorado Supreme Court saying that it is the public entity who can raise or waive this issue is strong case law on point, as well as case law that says we should look to the policy of the CGIA when applying the CGIA, but you're absolutely right that we don't have any case law discussing a private intervener such as this one raising the CGIA.
One follow-up question, if I may. Your opponent cites Layman versus City of Louisville, which appears to be very close to your facts, a zoning case that a panel of this court decided could arise in tort, and Louisville was cited with approval by the Colorado Supreme Court in Robinson. So how do you distinguish Layman?
I would distinguish Layman because in that case it was a statement that was relied upon, and that's what gives right to a tort-based theory of relief, whereas here the reliance was only and undisputably on the promise. The evidence before Judge Frick showed that the permit is the promise. The permit is the only thing that Open Door relied upon. They, as my opposing counsel stated, he went into the representative for Open Door Ministries, went into the zoning administration on December 30th, 2010, did have a conversation about what the zoning code would allow, had many conversations about this previously, and it was none of those conversations on December 30th or earlier on which Open Door relied. What they relied upon was a permit that says, you may use 740 Clarkson as a rooming and boarding house.
So do you disagree with your opposing counsel that he said the conduct we're talking about today is saying you can get a permit? What you're saying is the permit itself is the promise.
Completely disagree with that characterization by opposing counsel. All the evidence at the trial and before Judge Frick showed that what Open Door relied upon was the permit. It did not do anything until it had the permit in hand, and the permit clearly states 740 Clarkson may be used as a rooming and boarding house now and into the future, a promise of future conduct, which is exactly what Delosier discusses when evaluating whether it's properly a promissory estoppel case or otherwise lies in tort. But there simply is no tort here. There's no negligent misrepresentation. There's certainly no intentional misrepresentation, as you recognized. There's no misrepresentation at all. There is 18 months of litigation that finally results in Judge Freck saying, you know, I don't think that your interpretation of the law actually supports this permit, but that does not make 18 months ago the zoning administrator's belief in what the law stated and what it permitted and what it today still wishes to permit a misrepresentation at that time.
So your position is the language of the permit itself is the promise?
Correct.
Do you have any law that says that other than the Texas case you cited?
There's the T-Mobile case, which is a Denver District Court case that Judge Bayless decided, where he found a zoning permit under very similar facts to be a promise to erect a cell phone tower, and that reliance upon that zoning permit, the permit was the promise. In addition to that case being squarely on all fours, factually, the Colorado Supreme Court and Colorado Court of Appeals case law on what is a promise and what a promise for future conduct also supports the finding here. This is clearly a promise. The city agrees that it's a promise, and Judge Frick agrees that it's a promise. Going back to additional reasons why, regardless of whether this is a promissory estoppel or can be considered equitable estoppel, there's still additional reasons why the CGIA here just simply doesn't apply. Open Door has not suffered an injury that would trigger the jurisdictional notice period. The CGIA requires notice under subsection 1 of section 109, requiring any person who claims to have suffered an injury to file written notice as provided elsewhere in this section.
What about the ruling by Judge Frick that said you have no right to this permit and I'm vacating the permit? Didn't that put them on notice that their right to a permit was tentative and they could suffer injuries if they couldn't get a permit?
Absolutely, which is exactly why they had the promissory estoppel case that they brought before Judge Frick.
Right.
To avoid any injury.
Yes, but your opponent's claim, I'm just asking you to respond to their argument, if I may.
Please.
Their argument is that at least as to the day the judge in district court, Judge Frick, entered her order, at that point, your client was on notice and should have sent the CJI notice, the CJIA notice. Do you want to respond to that?
Thank you. Certainly that would be the case should the CGIA apply, and should that be actually considered notice under the CGIA, or excuse me, injury under the CGIA, which actually specifically is defined as injury to person or property, which at that point had not yet occurred. But assuming that it was an injury that would trigger the CGIA, and assuming that the CGIA applies, the cross claim itself provides exactly the type of notice that subsection 1, which is the only issue, the only section of the CGIA that could apply here, requires: written notice to the city. The form of that notice, the timing of that notice, and the other parts of subsection 109 that are in the statute are all waivable, are not jurisdictional, and were waived by not being raised below. Regardless, they didn't need to be waived because the CGIA obviously doesn't apply. But there was no basis for finding that the city was not on written notice. Certainly the purpose of the written notice is that so the city may evaluate a claim, may decide, do I want to litigate, do I want to settle, do I want to resolve this somehow, which is exactly what happened here. So the purpose of the notice was resolved. The city could have chosen to raise its hand and stay the case and say, I want to evaluate, or you need to refile it and file notice that complies with section 2, subsection 2 of 109, or subsection 6 of 109, and it didn't. There's no dispute that the city was on written notice of the claim, and that satisfies the jurisdictional requirement to be in court if the CGIA were found to be applicable here.
What is the policy here? I'd like to just ask about that briefly, where you have the city deciding this is good, we want this housing here, but the neighbors don't want it, and the city won't defend or raise defenses that it can raise. Why shouldn't the adjacent homeowners or others, such as taxpayers, have the right to come in and raise those issues?
Well, the taxpayers or adjoining landowners have other avenues to raise those disputes if they think that the zoning code does not actually permit the use, and that's exactly what Mr. Lipschutz did here. He sued to revoke the permit, the Board of Adjustments upheld the permit, the Board of Adjustments and the city agreed that this type of rooming and boarding use is something we intended to allow under the current zoning, and that that is a decision that the city has the right to make and certainly can consider adjoining landowners and taxpayers' considerations. But it is not something that then becomes an adjoining landowner's right to change legislatively or through the courts or otherwise. That's just simply not an issue here. The city.
But what they're trying to change, as I understand it, is just the estoppel lawsuit. Without the estoppel lawsuit that Judge Frick said could go forward granting summary judgment, your clients have no case.
And so the CGIA, which only applies to tort-based claims or injuries, recognizes that the city should, in other situations, answer for liability they would have otherwise, answer for liability they would have in a contract-based theory like promissory estoppel.
But if they're right, legally, if this is a tort, what remedy do they have as adjacent landowners? Your client has been granted the relief from Judge Frick.
Correct.
They're running their program. I'm sure it's a very noble endeavor.
Thank you.
And I don't even think your opponents dispute that. They just don't want it.
That's
in
right.
Their backyard.
That's right. And that's the problem, I guess, with living in a community and the zoning laws as they're written, right? The city has enacted specific zoning laws to keep that neighborhood from becoming what they call institutionalized. That is why we are at issue here with a rooming and boarding permit and not some other kind of use. Open Door Ministry specifically scaled down its operations to be able to fit into this neighborhood. Certainly adjoining landowners have the right to complain if there's harm from this operation that still is yet to occur. That's obviously never happened and not in the record, and it was not before Judge Frick, is not before this court now. But there are other avenues for an adjoining landowner to challenge that action that actually might harm his or her land. Here, he doesn't like the fact that the zoning, as interpreted by the zoning administrator on this day, actually allowed for the permit. Judge Frick has then determined that as interpreted on that day was incorrect and that the permit was issued inappropriately, and therefore, that's why we came before the court with Judge Frick for promissory estoppel. We met the requirements for promissory estoppel, and the adjoining landowner's remedy was to challenge the meeting of promissory estoppel, but it doesn't take away Open Door's right to assert and to meet the requirements for a promissory estoppel claim.
I assume you also disagree with their argument that summary judgment should not have been granted.
I disagree with the argument that summary judgment should not have been granted.
That was
an easy one, right? Judge Frick had undisputed facts before her. The city and Open Door agree on all the relevant facts. There was a promise, that there was reliance, that reliance was reasonable, and that injustice would result if the promise was revoked. And this case is easy for this court too, I would submit, that the city and Open Door agree on all these things. There was no genuine issue, and Mr. Lipschutz's proper remedy as an adjoining homeowner, if he thinks that the rooming and boarding use is somehow being exceeded or damaging his property, can call the city, can call the police, can
Counsel,
call the
I see
money.
You're out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. The first point I want to address, Judge Furman, is a point you raised, which is its jurisdictional bar. And I direct the court's attention to Mesa County School District number 51 versus Kelsey, 8P 1200. The distinction here is if the city wants to settle a claim, it can settle a claim outside the court system. What Kelsey holds is that this trial courts and this court only can take jurisdiction of a claim subject to the CGIA if there is compliance with the notice requirements. It specifically says those requirements cannot be waived, there can be no estoppel. They are predicates to exercising jurisdiction over a claim subject to the CGIA. I'd like to kind of pick up a little bit on Judge Rothenberg on something you said with a story that's attributed to Thompson Marsh over at DU. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but in his real property class, people have said that he'd get to the zoning chapter and just close the book and say, it's all political, there's nothing for me to teach you. That in effect is what's going on here. The city does have a political agenda that in this case favors ODM, but as Roosevelt said, homeowners, adjacent property owners, are endowed with the protections afforded by the zoning of adjacent properties upon the stability of which property owners should be entitled to rely. So we are entitled to come here and make sure and identify for this court issues that are properly before it and issues that are not properly before it. To address a few other points that were raised, the relief being sought here is to prevent revocation of the permit that was ordered by the court in Robinson and a variety of other cases. The Colorado Supreme Court has recognized that the gist of equitable estoppel is that it's a defensive doctrine. It's used to stop a municipality in this context from doing something it otherwise would do based on some misleading statement it made. The T-Mobile case, which is a Denver District Court case, interestingly first said it was equitable estoppel, then without really explaining why, the judge changed his mind and said, well, it's promissory estoppel. I submit that's not authority for, or not controlling, certainly not controlling, but not even persuasive authority for this court, because it doesn't analyze the nature of the zoning power. It doesn't analyze the types of issues that relate to whether a zoning permit is a representation of fact as to what's authorized or a promise. I thought you had a question. I'm sorry.
No.
Thank you, Your Honor. My time is up. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.